Thank you. Thank you. I woke up this morning with a song in my heart. And when one prepares to be present to a book like this, you're always waiting for the word to come, waiting for the kernel to emerge. And I hope today, as we unpack and explore chapter 4, that there will be many kernels for you. But this is what came on my heart this morning. I want Jesus to walk with me. I want Jesus to walk with me all along my pilgrim journey. Oh, I want Jesus to walk with me. If you know it, sing along. I want Jesus to walk with me. I want Jesus to walk with me all along my pilgrim journey. Oh, I want Jesus to walk with me. As you know, John Michael has written, John Philip Newell, I was thinking of John Michael Talbot. That song brought a lot up for me. Has written a number of books, and this was one that we actually were introduced to on Iona when we had a pilgrimage group there in 1911. That's right. Oh, don't we look great? And this is a wonderful book called Praying with the Earth. And there's an accompanying CD to this. But I thought we'd start with the Thursday prayer, because I think it speaks to the themes here. Not because we have made peace this day, not because we have treated each other as ourselves, not because we have walked the earth with reverence today, but because there is mercy, because there is grace, because your spirit has not been taken from us, we come, thirsting for peace, thirsting for love, hungering for wholeness. When my grandson's mother, River's mother, who is my daughter, but we, if you're a grandparent, you know you often talk about your grandchild's parent as just the person, not the name. She calls me frequently, and she called me this week because she knew this presentation was coming, and she said, "So how's it going, Mom? And by the way, what's the title of the book?" And I said, "Rebirthing God, Christianity's Struggle for a New Beginning." And she was quiet for a minute or two, took a deep breath, and she said, "Mom, I'm overwhelmed just hearing the title." And we may find just the title daunting in the context of Christianity, in the context of what we're being invited to contemplate in this book and think about. It is a book that is both stimulating and confrontive. And I always find the books written by this author as both extremely stimulating and very confrontive. He's always asking questions. Most of you have either met him here or read several of his books, and you know, as I often say, he is the real deal. I have seen him on Iona, I've met him in a train station, and he is who he is in his writing. Sometimes we're a little, I'm a little anxious when I've read someone's work and then I have an opportunity to meet them and I think, oh man, can they be in sink. And he certainly is. He's thoughtful. He's deeply grounded in the Christian tradition. And he challenges us, whether in a personal encounter or in his writing, to really live faith, hope, and love. In the opening chapter of the book, he says, we can be part of midwifery or midwifing new holy births in the world. What a profound thought. And that was really brought home to me almost a year ago when my husband and I were presented with the opportunity to be at the birth of our grandson. We hadn't anticipated that. It wasn't planned ahead. But our daughter, when the nurse came in who said, I'm going to be the delivery nurse, she said, oh, I'm going to catch your baby. And Katie said, where are you from? Oh, Glasgow. And we went, oh my gosh. And Katie said, Mom and Daddy have to be here. It's like Scotland all over again. So on the basis of a Glaswegian accent, we got to be at our grandson's birth. In that experience, over many hours, I was blessed to be present to pain and suffering, joy and wonder, and lots of noise. And I think those are elements in rebirthing. Pain and wonder, joy and awe, and struggle. In chapter 4, the chapter we're exploring today, we find the suggestion that there are waymarkers or signposts for the journey, and with those come some accompanying really audacious questions. And I would like to explore today in the plethora of material here. I mean, it's like one chapter is a whole book. Three things that speak deeply to me. The first is yearning or longing. In the unknown depths of our soul is where it begins, with yearning and longing. And I would contend that this is a physical experience. We are invited by John Philip in this book to contemplate the outward journey and the inward journey, the soul quest, deep within, and at the same time to move out into the world and particularly to honor and explore different spiritual traditions, not to compete with Christianity, but as he says, to complete us. And that has certainly been my experience, because different traditions offer different gifts to the world. And lastly, he speaks eloquently about the transformative power of new beginnings. And that yearning that takes us and moves us forward. But I would contend more often than not that a new beginning is an ending. We have to achieve or experience the end before the new can happen. I know many of you know John O'Donohue's work, and in a wonderful little book he wrote called To Bless the Space Between Us, a book of blessings, he writes this: longing or yearning is divine discontent, the unenderable present finding a physical doorway to awe and discovery that frightens and ennobles, humiliates and beckons, makes us into pilgrim souls, and sets us on some road that starts in the center of the body and then leads us out like an uncaring invitation, like a comet passing, leaving only its trail, glimpsed for a moment, but making us willing to give up our perfect house, our paid-for home, and our accumulated belongings. Kind of like Jesus when he says, come follow me. Well, I have studied Kundalini yoga for many, many years and was fortunate to study that form of yoga and teach that form of yoga with Sikh or Sikh teachers. They were practicing Sikhs. This is very common that people who... The Sikh tradition teaches that yoga is a preparation for prayer and meditation. So one often engages in yoga before one meditates. Having studied with them, I really yearned to go to India. And I really wanted to go to the capital of the Sikh world, their most holy place, which is in Amritsar, up in the Punjab in the north, and to a place called the Golden Temple. Like Mecca or Jerusalem or Rome, this is the place where Sikhs have their heart. And it is considered an obligation that every person, man and women, will visit the Golden Temple at least once in their lifetime. Now, if you've been to India, you know it is overwhelming. The sights, the sounds, the smells, the chaos, the lack of traffic guards everywhere. But it is also a place of many religions, where you might find a Hindu temple on one corner and right behind it a mosque. Down the street, a gurdwara, a Sikh gurdwara, or a Buddhist temple. Now, that doesn't mean they all get along. And historically, there have been many difficulties. But I want to paint that picture because that's the landscape of India, all that diversity. A Sikh, or a Sikh, is a disciple, a learner. I like that, a disciple. There are between 25 and 28 million Sikhs in the world. And we have a growing number of communities here in the United States and in Canada, particularly on the West Coast. It is a monotheistic religion that grew in the hotbed of all the traditions of India, Buddhism, Islam, many, many others. And it is based on the teaching of 11 gurus, or 11 teachers. And when the last guru died, he said that now the teachings are in the book, and their sacred book is called the Guru Granth Sahib. So when you go to a worship space, the text is read, much like Christian worship. Someone explains it, but there's no priestly class. It's everyone can have a shot at it. I have been blessed to make two month-long spiritual pilgrimages to India in the last few years. The first time I went with my daughter, she had been in India, and she kept saying, "Mom, we got to go. And I agreed to go as long as we didn't stay any of those flea bag hotels that she, on $5 a day, right? So we did up the ante a little. But the most important thing to me on that trip was to get to Amritsar. We arrived at midnight, and I remember we'd arranged for someone to pick us up at the train station, but we waited and waited, and no one came, and it was getting darker and darker, and finally someone did pick us up. But I asked them not to take us to our hotel. I wanted to go immediately to the Golden Temple. Before you enter the structure of the temple itself, there are transitional spaces or liminal zones that are very important. And another thing to understand is that gurdwaras or temple grounds are open 24 hours a day. So people come in to pray at all times of the day and night. So I knew we'd be comfortable there. Before you enter the structure of the Golden Temple, which is suspended on a gird, which is a water element, Hindu temples are that way as well, you remove your shoes. At Amritsar, in the Golden Temple, there are people just like yourselves who come from all over the Sikh world volunteering to take your shoes, and they put them in little slots and you get a number. And before you enter the grounds, you walk through a flowing water element to wash your feet in preparation. Let's see here. Yeah. Coming through the arches, you see the temple grounds, and you'll see a number of people walking, and they circumambulate in prayer around the temple. And women cover their heads. Men, typically in the Sikh tradition, wear turbans. There is a very interesting, and there's the Golden Temple, and you can see there are structures all around, and at each entryway there's a place to leave your shoes and enter the water. And then this is the Golden Temple, which you enter on the left-hand side, and you'll see quite a parade of people coming to that sacred place. In this structure, much like our churches, there is a kitchen where a vegetarian meal is available 24/7. That idea of serva, of service, is very important. There's a sleeping area, so if you're poor and not able to afford a hotel, you can sleep on the temple grounds. And the only time the temple itself is closed is at midnight to 2 a.m., and a team of volunteers come in, and it's really a sacred duty to clean the temple, to be selected to clean the temple. And usually there's music playing, except for that time when they clean out, and they have musical groups from all over India that feel honored to come and play. The Gurdwara means the door to the teacher, and people are welcome here, regardless of spiritual tradition, of ethnicity. It's a very much open door worship place. I have to say, I felt my Christianity profoundly in a new way in this place. I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure, because that happens at such a deep level. I found in the people that were worshiping and in the structures they had set up to welcome a vitality that vibrated in the space. It was invigorating. These people were not there to talk about their religion. They were there to actualize it in service, by serving food, by cleaning rooms, by cleaning the marble floors. It's quite a physical work, but that's a great honor. And I felt in this place that I was a Christian, but I was very, very welcomed there. Well, I was very stunned on the morning of August 5th, 2012, when shots were fired in the Wisconsin Gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Six Sikh members of the community were killed by a white supremacist, and several others were wounded. I felt that wound in my being. I had worshipped with these people. I'd been taught by these people. I appreciated so deeply who they are and are trying to be. And when I heard that the people that were shot were in the kitchen preparing langar, which is the common meal, it was very distressing. So this yearning was very strong, and I said to my husband, I have to go to a vigil. I need to be with this community and share in their grief and stand in their vulnerability. Because at that time, there were still a lot of threats, and continue to be, to the Sikh community, because a lot of people see the turban and they think Islam. So we decided to go. And my husband and I went to the vigil at the Sikh Gurdwara in Orange County. It is an incredible place, and I was eager to go to that particular Gurdwara because the law enforcement community was coming to be present to them as well, and I wanted to hear what the law enforcement community had to say. First of all, we walked in, and we were greeted by these enthusiastic and beautiful young people, and they all had T-shirts on remembering the day. They invited us to a meal in a langar in the kitchen, and we actually have found an Indian restaurant down the street. I'd forgotten about langar, so we had our meal before we got there. They offered my husband a turban or some kind of head covering, because the men would wear that in worship, and I'd been to enough worship experiences to know I needed to have a shawl to cover my head. Then they guided us to the worship space upstairs. It was lovely. I said to my husband, why don't you sit? They had some chairs way back, because normally you are in yoga pose when you're in worship. And he went back, and I decided to take a little time to go to the front. I always like to sit in the front and meditate. And I was moving into some deep meditation, and I felt this tug on my sleeve. And I turned around, and this beautiful young woman said, you're on the wrong side. It had been so long since I'd been at worship in a gurdwara that I forgot women sit on one side and the men sit on the other. But it was a wonderful experience because these women took me in. And I will say, this gurdwara, these in this community were Indian. And some gurdwaras are a mix of American Sikhs, but this was largely an Indian community. Through that evening, with songs and sacred texts and candlelight and thoughtful words by the law enforcement community, it was very clear that since 9/11, the Orange County law enforcement community was very attuned to this gurdwara. They knew each other. I felt the different threads of who we were and what brought us there to be woven together in incredible peace. So, what do different religious traditions offer our soul self and our world? How do we take the Western perspective of transcendence, where we are in search of a connection with God, not to confuse ourselves as God, and the Eastern perspective of divine eminence, where the withinness of the sacred in the soul is very important in life? A lot of questions. I don't have the answers. And the older I get, the more questions I have. So we'll come back to that a little bit. The next thing John Philip talks about is the outward journey, inward journey. It is an incredible thing to think of oneself as a pilgrim. Peregrine and peregrination is the word for pilgrimage, where we seek a place of resurrection or rebirthing in the world. That's the pilgrim's task. On a quest for places where true openness of heart and relationships can be found. Journey into the forgotten, unknown depths of our souls and traditions. And as John Philip says, to look into the eyes of another and see the infinite. That's what is said when one says namaste. In the Sikh tradition, the greeting is Sat Nam. While I was working on this week, we went over to Whole Foods to grab a bite to eat. And I turn around and there's this beautiful Sikh woman. She wore a turban, and often American Sikhs wear white. And I had just come from contemplation of these things in my memories of Amritsar. And the first thing I did is walk over to her and say, Sat Nam. And she greeted me back. It was almost as though that old conditioning or experience was deep in my soul. And I said, are you here to teach? Because many Sikhs are yoga teachers. She said, no, I'm just visiting friends. And we chatted. Still, I'm amazed that in the midst of this, I'm having this encounter, because I've never encountered a Sikh person in Santa Barbara. And finally, she looked at me and she said, what is your name? And I said, Ravi Harkar. My first response in our exchange was my spiritual name in the Sikh tradition. And when one becomes a yoga teacher, one receives a spiritual name that is to reflect who they are. And so these things are very deep within us when we go on the journey. While working on my book, Finding the Waymarkers, which my husband says I should flash up, and this was a number of years ago, I had an opportunity to spend time with the community of Aden and Hilda, which is located on the island of Lindisfarne. And I think this is my favorite, one of my favorite pictures until I had grandchildren, because the mother and father and grandparents had come for a blessing for this new child in Amritsar, and they asked me to give a blessing too. These things stay in your soul. So, the island of Lindisfarne is the place where St. Cuthbert, now he was almost a little later than Columba, but a contemporary in some ways in the 600s, who extended Christianity to the east. Columba kind of went north with instilling Christianity to the Scots. And after his death, there were a series of abbeys built along the River Tweed, Berwick-on-Tweed, if you've been there. There's a river that empties into the sea. And these abbeys were within walking distance, actually very connected to Roman communities during that time, and they used the same roadway. But when you walk St. Cuthbert's Way, you walk on this ancient path that goes along the river, and you walk across Scotland and then into England, and you come to Holy Isle. So I was there visiting with this community, and the founder, it's a contemporary Christian community, Ray Simpson, I said, would you mind looking at my draft? Let me know what you think. And he sat and read for a while, and he said, you know, the only thing I don't see here is, or I do see, is your pilgrimage places are either in the UK or Europe. Don't you have any place in the U.S.? And that really took me back, because sometimes we think we have to go to India, we have to go some wild exotic place. And so for that next year, I made a vow to visit what I considered to be some pilgrimage places in the U.S. We went to Arlington Cemetery on Veterans Day. Whoa. Very powerful. Very powerful. One of the most stunning 9/11 memorials for me is the Pentagon. And if you've ever been there, there's a bench built for every victim of that plane flight. And they're built on an angle from the youngest to the oldest. And like the flight headed into the building there in a V, it is so powerful. It's holy ground. And I learned later that at that V, the Pentagon has built a chapel where the plane went in. They had never had a chapel before 9/11 at the Pentagon. And now they have a chaplain staff, and a sacred space where they've done weddings and memorials. It's incredible. We visited the national parks. Another memorial that's very powerful, if you've seen the Luther King Memorial in Washington, D.C., it's historic and powerful. Another memorial that deeply moved me in Washington was the memorial to the Korean veterans. They're moving. It's active. It's very different than, say, the wall. I went to visit the monks of New Millery Abbey. They're casket makers. That's their mission in life. And I walked in their forest where they organically grow the trees and cut them down and make caskets that they send all over the world. I met up with some people who've walked the old mission way. This has kind of grown out of the Camino. Now people are starting to walk the Camino in California and visit the old missions and stay at the old mission site. And that was very interesting. Philip Newell says that quotes Julian of Norwich, that we are made of God. We are made of God. So we carry that essence with us wherever we go, reconnecting to wisdom. So places of pilgrimage are to be found where our yearning and longing meet sacred ground. So when you there's a little symbol there. It's the symbol of St. Cuthbert's Way. And you know, the British are big walkers. They love to walk. And actually, in this part, in the borders of England, there are a lot of trails that intersect. But that's the symbol. When you get toward the island, it was traditional. There now is a causeway that goes out, but you have to do it only at low tide. But I wanted to do the real pilgrim thing, and we walked across the mudflats to the Holy Isle, which is what the pilgrims do. And along the way, as you walk across the mudflats, you'll see a little tower. And those were built so that when the tide was coming in and you couldn't quite make it to the Holy Isle, you could climb up and stay in one of these little perches like a blind until it passed. And this is a view of the ruins of the abbey on the Holy Isle. And this is a very interesting statue because apparently St. Cuthbert was buried because they were worried about the Vikings taking his body away, and then later some monks brought it back to be buried on the Holy Isle. It's a castle at the top of the hill. Okay.
Lindisfarne.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm mindful of time. Okay. Okay, perfect. So I own, this is a quote I want to offer you. Robert McFarlane, who wrote a wonderful book about walking in England and Scotland, wrote, I think this is relevant to our subject today, cognition is sight-specific or motion-sensitive, that we think differently in different landscapes. I like that. I think differently in India when I'm surrounded with the sights and sounds and smells. I think differently when I'm on Lindisfarne. Where do you think differently? And do you get yourself there from time to time? Anyway, he goes on to say, therefore, more radically, and certain thoughts might not be possible except in certain places. So our thinking and our being are affected by the place. Such that when we lose those places, or I would argue don't put ourselves in those places, we are losing a kind of imagination as well. So putting ourselves in places that elicit, or where our longing meets that deep hunger. Well, I know a lot of you have heard about Iona. It is a place of pilgrimage for me and many, many others. And I remember the first time I went there, I'd actually heard about Iona from my Presbyterian friends, some of them members of this church. Oh, you should hear about the music, and it's great, and blah, blah, blah. And I'm thinking, okay. So we were on sabbatical in Scotland, and I said to my husband, I think I'll go and spend a week with the community as a start, a holy start to our sabbatical. And I fell in love. It was the beauty, the worship, the music, the being present with other Christians from all over the world, and their daily round of prayer and work really met my soul. So at the end, I said, you know, I think I want to go back and spend more time as, you know, benchmarking this, the ending of our sabbatical. And he said, oh, I don't know if you should do that. He said, you know, it won't be the same. Can't be the same. You kind of got on this high. Can't be the same. I didn't believe it. And I've gone there once a year, ever since, at least. And I spent 3 months working with the community. Work and prayer, work and prayer. Isn't that what Benedict said? Work and prayer, work and prayer. And it really works for me. So, on Iona, there's an outward journey, and you're invited, always invited, to an outward journey and an inward journey. And this is coming in. You'll see the structures at the top of the abbey, and those are gone now. So this is an older picture, but I love it. It's a clear, beautiful day, and you don't always get that. Now, the journey, which is our chapter today, is to Iona is fraught with adventure. We were just talking about it this morning. First, you have to get to Glasgow, and that generally means a plane trip or a train trip. From Glasgow, you take the 8 o'clock train from the train station and on your way for 3.5 hours to Oban, which is a port town. At Oban, you get on a ferry and you go to Mull. At Mull, Craignure, you get on a bus and you take an hour and a half bus trip across the island of Mull. Then you take another ferry to get to Iona. Then you walk up to the abbey. So the journey just to get to the place. I mean, in modern times, we go, oh, my goodness. Historically, that's pretty mild. Pilgrims often wrote letters of what to do with their property and their belongings before they left on pilgrimage because most people didn't come back. I've come back to tell the tale. It is an amazing place. Now, we were there at a time when the community offers, and still does, and John Philip talks about it, a pilgrim around the island. And it's a day, usually a Tuesday or Wednesday, where the staff of the community takes you to some sacred places around the island. But when we were there, one trip, the wind was howling. That may have been the time they closed the ferry, so you couldn't get back and forth. And they invited us to a pilgrimage in the abbey, inside the abbey. Oh. It's a long, narrow structure with a cruciform, so on either side. And there are long, big, old windows in the 1100s. It's been, of course, repaired and remodeled, but a lot of that has gone on. There's sacred areas for prayer and where one can leave prayer requests. But at each of the spots along the way, this is the outer courtyard, and there are beautiful sandstone carvings of the life of Christ. This is the baptismal font and a lot of Celtic symbology around the outside, the sending dove. Oh! There she is. 1911, still looking good. Keeping that abbey up. And this is at the Bay of New Beginnings that John Philip talks a lot about. There's a labyrinth there. And in addition to all the stones and everything else, there's a labyrinth. But what happened when we took that pilgrimage inside of the abbey is we did all the same things. We just did them in an enclosed space, not in the great outdoors. And it taught me a lot about pilgrimage can be anywhere, anytime, any place. But there were some traditional elements. I may have talked in the past about a nun named Egeria. Egeria was an adventuress. She was a nun who traveled the Holy Land in 3rd, 4th century. She wrote letters home to her sisters, and we have those letters, copies of those letters, where she writes about going to Mount Sinai, being near the burning bush, going to Jerusalem, the liturgies of the day, even at that time. But wherever they go, wherever they stop, there are certain things they do. The first thing is they say a prayer. The second thing is they read a lection. And in Egeria's case, it was always from what they call the Book of Moses, Exodus. Then they read a psalm, and then they sang a song. Those four things. Now, those four elements are always on the outward pilgrimage on Iona, but we did them inside as well. And at each of the sacred spaces in the church, we had a prayer, read a text, read a psalm, sang a song related to that special spot. And what grew for me in that was we could do that in any sacred space. We could do that in our own churches. We could do it. I was very moved when my husband and I became Episcopalians, long story, but our rector at the time, our associate rector, gave us a pilgrimage at Trinity inside. It was wonderful, so powerful. And the same thing, we went to sacred places in our sacred place and blessed them and prayed and sang. So I think it's a very, very important part of pilgrimage. And you never know what you're going to find when you go on pilgrimage. I was walking the beach on Iona and nearly crushed these eggs. And there are certain birds that nest in the spring and only lay their eggs in the sand. I mean, it was just out there. And so I think another important part of the outward and inward pilgrimage is to be surprised and to be ready for that. And I'm telling you, I've never been there in July when they take the lambs away, but I hear it's terrible. So I'm just going in the spring or the fall. This is Dunny, which is the highest point on Iona, and John Philip talks about that as part of the pilgrimage. They actually don't go up to Dunny with pilgrimage groups anymore because it was really wearing away the topsoil and the path was worn. But there's a cairn, and we'll talk a little bit about cairns after the break. Pile of stones. Stones really come out a lot in this book, don't they? Stones are everywhere. And they're powerful, and they say a lot about remembrance. Anyway, this is up on Dani, and people often take prayers or additional stones up there. Okay. I think I'm going to stop there, because I have a little more material, and then we'll do some questions. So, Satnam.